Hey guys.
Yo yo.
Hey, so this is our last episode, season one of We Rebel, coming to a close.
Wishing you all a happy holiday season and new year.
And new year, yes, yes.
Before we get into it with the news, we wanted to say that we are interviewing someone very special today. We're interviewing Michael Blake, who is a New York Assemblyman from the 79th District. He's one of the co-chairs of New Leaders Council, and he is a vice chair of the Democratic National Committee. He was also one of the early most influential organizers of Barack Obama's election campaign in 2007. He's heavily featured in By the People, the election of Barack Obama, like our good friend, Ronnie Cho.
So stick around for that, but let's get into the news.
Yeah, so there was big news this week. Doug Jones won. We have a Democratic senator in Alabama for the first time in 25 years.
This is so exciting.
Huge deal.
So, so the AP, Kim Chandler and Steve Peoples from the AP wrote that in a stunning victory aided by scandal, Democrat Doug Jones won Alabama's special election on Tuesday, beating back history and a battle Republican opponent and President Donald Trump, who urgently endorsed GOP rebel Roy Moore despite a litany of sexual misconduct allegations. It was the first Democratic Senate victory in a quarter century.
One of the reddest states.
Yeah, it's wild.
Can we think about that for a second? This is really, I mean, I know he won by a small amount, and we'll get into that in a minute, and, you know, people's claims on what that means, but this is a big deal. Mm-hmm. You know, this is what we need to think of when we're like, you know, oh, wow, we didn't win this election and that election as Democrats and think the world's ending, even though it's not. Like, this is big. This is good.
Yeah.
Take the W and let's keep going.
And I think it's important, too, because it puts the Senate map into play in 2018.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I think that we're going to take back the House if we get everybody out. I think that we should pressure, but this is good.
Absolutely.
Voter
turnout is going to be a big factor in this because, you know, complacency is the biggest downfall, especially when it comes to Democrats and voting in non-general elections. So we definitely need to make sure that everyone turns out because as evidence, you know, in this election for the Alabama Senate, you know, black voters were
made
a huge reason why Doug Jones won.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And well, so that's covered in the New York Times. Richard Fawcett and Campbell Robertson wrote, African-American voters played an essential role in electing Democrat Doug Jones over his scandal-scarred Republican rival, Roy Moore. Brian Stevenson, the founder of Equal Justice Initiative, which is based in Montgomery, Alabama, said there's no state in America where black people recognize the horrors of turning back the clock more than the state of Alabama.
That is so true.
There's a consciousness about this history in the African-American community. According to CNN exit polling, 30% of the electorate was African-American, with 96% of them voting for Mr. Jones. Mr. Jones' backers had felt he needed to get north of 25% to have a shot to win. A remarkable 98% of black women voters supported Mr. Jones. The share of black voters on Tuesday was higher than the share in 2008 and 2012 when Barack Obama was on the ballot. I thought this was also interesting. The final county to get called was Selma, which I think how symbolic is that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I talked about this with some friends this week, but I think now is truly the time. I think that there's always so much about like garnering the black vote, you know, and there's always these implications that the African-American turnout is not high. That's not true. The African-American community is so engaged and has always been on the Democratic side. And I think now is a huge turning point for the Democratic Party to listen to issues affecting and not just court the black vote, but actually support.
Fold them into strategy moving forward and bringing them to the table as, you know, advisors and candidates and citizens and at all levels. It's super important.
Absolutely. Now we need to walk the walk.
Well, yeah, because and also like take into effect that we have a lot of gerrymandering issues. So now we need to go in and work on this whole redistricting issue.
Oh, my gosh.
Make sure that, you know, we're not, you know, black voters aren't being discounted or they're being, you know, there's still some talks of voter suppression that was happening during this election. You know, people being, you know, not being told that their IDs weren't valid. You know, there's still a lot of these issues going on. So in terms of elections, yes, we need to make sure that everyone has an equal opportunity to do so. But then also, yes, as Emily was saying, now engage them when it's not November. Now engage them when it's not an election.
Exactly.
Find out what's happening in their community. Help them out with education, with jobs, you know, energy, and, you know, all that stuff.
And also not writing them off. Like, I think a lot of the GOP Republican conversation around the Barack Obama was like, oh, of course they voted for him. He's black. And it's like, no. These African-American citizens have a mind and they understand platforms, and they voted for Barack Obama because that's what they believe in. And so I think it's really interesting, this point here about the share of black voters on Tuesday night was higher than the share in 2008 and 2012 when Barack Obama was on the ballot, because they're showing up for the issues. They're showing up for the party. You know, they're not just showing up for the black candidate.
Right.
You know, it's really important that we as Democrats don't just be like, great, we have a black candidate, we get all the black vote. Like, that's really disrespectful and completely writes off their minds and their thoughtfulness and them as people. And I think that's a really interesting point on a super small scale. So I think it's really exciting.
And I think, too, one of the things I wanted to mention was there's been a lot of talk about how Doug Jones barely beat, you know, an accused pedophile. 1.5% was the margin, about 20,000 votes. And people are saying, oh, you know, that's it. I just want to be clear to our listeners and to progressives and Democrats everywhere that a win is a win. Yep. And there, we've talked to so many activists that talk about mental health and needing to celebrate wins and how important that is. And this is a win. This is a Democrat in Alabama. It doesn't matter if it was 0.3, 0.5, 2%, 1.5%. We have a Democrat in Alabama. We've increased our chances of retaking the Senate. That's incredibly important. But the other thing to remember is that Ralph Northam won the governorship in Virginia by 9 points instead of mm-hmm. the projected 2 to 3 points. And the reason that that happened was because people ran in districts or all around Virginia due to people like Amanda Littman and Run for Something. And that didn't happen in Alabama. It was just a Senate race. So in the future, run Democratic candidates in every single district. You will get more people energized to vote. And I think that Doug Jones wins by a much higher margin if you have people running. Jeff Sessions, I believe, ran unopposed the last time for the Senate. So not only do you have to have Democrats that are capable, but let's put them in different districts. Let's put them in different counties. Let's put Democrats on school boards. I'm pretty sure there are a lot of Alabama voters who feel disenfranchised because they have never seen a Democrat in the past almost 3 decades.
And
so,
and a lot of those people you're identifying are, you know, they're in the minority according to the traditional Alabama rhetoric as Democrats. So
right,
it's not like they're going to jump forward because maybe they own a small business and half of their, you know, farmers that come to their whatever the hell or half of their, you know, shoppers mm-hmm. are Republicans and they're scared. And that's a real thing. And so I think you're right. We need to provide support at all levels in all of the southern states and all of the red states, because there's definitely Democrats in all of those states.
Right.
Yeah.
And also the really quick circling back to the barely beat a pedophile. It's like, that's a good thing.
Right.
It's a good thing, that we beat a pedophile. And also that's not the only reason he won.
But yeah, mm-hmm. it's like, it's also like, why, what's the point of saying yeah. something like that?
Like mm-hmm. we can hyperanalyze it so we can learn from what happened and continue to get better. But if that's the only thing a fellow Democrat has to say about this, like, you're thinking about it wrong. Like, take the W. What can we do next? Yeah, this 1.5% is not enough. It's a W, but it's not enough. So let's keep working in Alabama. Let's move on to other elections and move forward instead of being like, well, he barely won because of the blah, blah, blah. Anyways.
So the last thing we'll say about Doug Jones, and this is unfortunate. This came out today, but Doug Jones was interviewed by, I think, Jake Tapper on CNN today, and he said that he doesn't think that Trump should resign because of sexual harassment allegations. That's unfortunate. I think that Doug Jones should support Trump resigning. I understand that he's a Democrat in Alabama. I do think that he needs to come out. And I mean, Doug Jones said, I think we need to move on and not get distracted by those issues. Let's get on with the real issues that are facing people of this country right now. And I don't think that the president ought to resign at this point. We'll see how things go. But certainly those allegations are not new. And he was elected with those allegations front and center. I don't think that that matters. I think that we are in this movement right now where we are listening to women. And so I think that Doug Jones, you know, yes, he's a Democrat. Yes, we're excited. Yes, progressive values might be protected for a little while longer. But when he says things like that,
yeah,
he has a brand new Senate phone number, which we don't have yet. But when we get it, we'll give it to you. Give him a call. Let him know that that's not a cool thing to say.
Right.
Yeah. And also, I feel like the way he framed that sounds like it's coming from a little bit of a place of fear. I mean, he's about
Absolutely.
To enter enter working directly with this man. And so who actively did not want him to win. So yeah, it's unfortunate, but again, let's take the W and move on to a not W with net neutrality.
So whoop, whoop. Yeah, the FCC repealed net neutrality.
Yeah, so this was covered by the New York Times. The author is Cecilia King, but essentially the Federal Commission's Federal Communications Commission voted on Thursday to dismantle rules regulating the businesses that connect consumers to the internet, granting broadband companies the power to potentially reshape Americans' online experiences. Who likes their broadband company? No one. Carrie, moving on. The agency scrapped the so-called net neutrality regulations that prohibited broadband providers from blocking websites or charging for higher quality service, allegedly, or certain content. The federal government will also no longer regulate high-speed internet delivery as if it were a utility like phone service. So this is insane. We've talked about this for the past, what, 4 or 5 episodes?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's just like completely debunking freedom of speech, freedom of what are some other fundamentals that my brain is skipping right now, but it's also backtracking so many ways.
But at this point, you know, having internet access is not necessarily, it's not just a privilege. Like, you have to, in order to apply for jobs, in order to apply for education, you know, like, it's a resource that we all have to use.
In order to fundraise.
And so the fact that they want to rescind these net neutrality rules just so that a couple companies can profit more, you know, that's a big slap in the face.
Companies who are notoriously the man, quote unquote, like it's not your local, you know, statewide body blah, like this is like AT&T,
yeah,
right, who's already taking advantage of the power they have.
And there are 9 attorney generals right now that are going to sue the FCC for their choice, and there are a lot of people arguing that a body of 5 non-elected officials should not have a say in something as wide-ranging as that. I think it's important. Some congressmen have talked about, we talked about this last time, have talked about bringing a vote to make it illegal for something like that to happen without congressional approval. So, and people are saying that vote might not happen for a while. I think it's important to call your reps and say, this vote should happen now because the internet will affect all of us.
Right.
You could still email all those guys, Michael O'Reilly, Brendan Carr and Ajit Pai, the Republicans who voted 3-2 in favor. I don't think that if you're an unelected official, you should have the power to remove net neutrality.
Well, also what bothers me about this is that, you know, the FCC, they're also ignoring all the complaints that came in about this. So it's not only that they made this decision, but they're blatantly going against the wishes of the American public. You know, this article actually came out on Motherboard through Vice. Is that the FCC is blocking law enforcement investigation into net neutrality comment fraud. So they, the FCC, they're blocking the investigation into the fraudulent comments designed to provide bogus support for the agency's net neutrality appeal. Mm-hmm. So they're actively doing things to A, make hinder the voices of people that are opposing them, and then B, just to make their own, basically they're in bed with all these corporations.
Right.
So this is not a good FCC right now. We need to, if we can, we can try to get this vote through Congress because something has to be done. This is not how it should be working.
No. Let's move on to something else that's kind of frustrating. So the tax bill
was finally... Don't worry, we have happy things later, everybody. Keep listening.
So the Republicans finally released their final tax bill ahead of the key vote next week. It actually just came out today that John McCain will not be available for that vote.
What?
It just broke today.
Wait, what?
Yeah, he won't be because he's undergoing cancer treatment.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Now I feel like an asshole. But no, seriously. Okay.
Yeah. So Republicans unveiled their final tax bill Friday evening, a step that will place them on track to vote on their plan next week and potentially have President Donald Trump sign it into law by the end of the year.
Oh, my God.
This is from a CNN article by Lauren Fox and Phil Mattingly. The bill, which critics say is heavily weighted to ease the tax burden of businesses rather than the middle class, drops the corporate tax rate down from 35% to 21%. It repeals the corporate alternative minimum tax and nearly doubles the standard deduction for individuals and restructures the way pass-through businesses like the Trump Company are taxed. While Republican leaders released a 2-page summary of the bill's contents, the summary did not include specific details on how the plan is funded. One of the key items Republicans have had to keep a close eye on is how much their bill costs. Under the Senate rules, the bill cannot cost more than $1.5 trillion over 10 years, and it cannot add to the deficit after that. The bill also sunsets the individual tax breaks at the end of 2025, and Republicans also repeal the individual mandate, a key part of the Affordable Care Act, to help finance the bill. So this is bad on multiple levels. This bill, I believe, has a 29% approval rating. Most people don't want it to happen. It is very business friendly. It kind of, I think, mirrors a lot of the economics of trickle down, which don't work. The Republicans are saying that once businesses get more money, then their employees will get more money. That's not how it works historically. A lot of economists have come out and said that this doesn't work. If you want to get involved, you can call the United States Capitol Switchboard at 202-224-3121. Then once you call that, you can request which senator you want to talk to, and they will patch you right through. Or you can go to 5calls.org. They will help out with that. You can text RESIST to 50409, and they will help you walk through that. If you want to text, which will send a fax to your representative's office. This is an all-hands-on-deck moment. This tax bill is awful. And the other thing that's really kind of upsetting about this is, and I wish the media wouldn't do this, but a lot of people in the media are saying that this is a big win for the Trump administration. What an amazing win for this would be. This isn't a win. When the Affordable Care Act was passed, it was a 60-40 vote majority, a super majority they went with. There were over 100 Republican amendments. It was debated for over a year and a half. This is going to be probably a 51-50 or a 52-49 vote if John McCain's not voting. 51-49. This is absurd. And it is a complete lack of economic authority, of moral authority.
And it affects everything. It's just
they're cheating. This isn't a win.
Right. Everything. Circling back to multiple interviews we've had with economists and founders of banks, like money cuts through, taxes cut through all of our other issues.
They're also refusing
to
see Doug Jones.
So there's going
to
be unbelievable cascading effects to this that affect our daily life. Like every day you do something that involves taxes. Yeah. You buy something, you sell something, you go to work. Like this affects everything.
Most of these Republicans haven't even read the bill. Like Bob Corker just came out and said that there was a provision that he had not read yet. Mike Lee said that he has a wavering support for the bill, but has not read it yet. It's ridiculous what's happening. When Scott Brown was elected in 2010, after Ted Kennedy died, Democrat leader Harry Reid held the vote until Scott Brown was seated. They're not even allowing Doug Jones to be seated. They're doing this for Luther Strange, who is a Republican appointed, not elected, to be involved in this vote. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's the same thing they did with Merrick Garland.
It's an abdication of democratic values.
But now they want to rush it through. I don't want to say that the only reason this would be considered a win is because they haven't had any significant legislation under Trump's administration passed in this basically his first year.
Right, but I mean, a win.
So that's the only reason they would call it
sure.
a win.
Because I know why they're calling it a win. I just think it's not a win. It's
a lose.
It's a lose.
Speaking of other things that are big loss, the CDC has received a list of forbidden words. So this was reported in the Washington Post amongst many other platforms. And this particular article is titled CDC gets a list of forbidden words, fetus, transgender, and diversity. Fetus, terrible. Which is, can I just say, a medical term? Mm-hmm. So
diversity.
Whoa. But essentially, the Trump administration is prohibiting officials at the nation's top public health agency from using a list of 7 words or phrases, including, quote, fetus, transgender, and official documents being prepared for next year's budget. Policy analysts at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, that's my hometown, were told a list of forbidden terms at a meeting on Thursday with senior CDC officials who oversee the budget, according to the analysts who took part of this 90-minute briefing, just a quick 90 minutes. Other terms including vulnerable, entitlement, diversity, transgender, fetus, evidence-based, and science-based.
Which we've used very proudly on this podcast.
Can I just say, it goes on. Instead of using those two last terms, evidence and science-based, the suggested phrase is, ready for this lofty fucking shit? CDC bases its recommendations on science in consideration with community standards and wishes.
Oof.
Are you fucking serious?
I mean,
the science community doesn't like wish evidence upon things. Like, oh, you know what I think I'm going to do? I'm going to wish this into existing after years of research. You fuck. Anyways, I can't even with this. And it goes on to talk about other things that have been happening in the Department of Health and Human Services. So the Health and Human Services, just FYI, have removed information about LGBT Americans from its website. The department's Administration for Children and Families, for example, just a quick archive, archived a page that outlined federal services that are available for LGBT people and their families, including how they can adopt and how they receive help if they are victims of sex trafficking.
Right. Like, why would you archive that information as if it's done and it's passed? Like,
do you know how many kids need fucking homes? or how many kids have been abused, no matter what their, you know, sexual status is.
Yeah.
Like, that's not an LGBT thing. You know, like, just because the kid is gay doesn't mean some fucking dude is not going to fuck him anyways, or some woman is not going to take advantage of him, which is really unlikely because women are amazing. But I'm just saying. I love you both so much. But you know what I mean? Like, that's absurd.
But listen, at this point, you know, this is one of those things where it's like, you know what? They might not use that in their language, but use it in yours. All right. These are words that mean something. You know, you can be vulnerable to certain diseases. You know, there's science-based, evidence-based information that is out there. Use these terms. Mm-hmm. Say these words, because they cannot take them from us.
And what's crazy is the fundamental role of the CDC is to protect the American public against key health threats. Mm-hmm. Like this affects everybody. Yeah. Like, this affects UDT, you know, like this, almost you can't, like, it's almost like this is like a agency you're not allowed to touch.
And this, but it reminds me of in the '80s when there was a bit, when they weren't talking about AIDS and HIV, and so many people were dying because they didn't have the information to take care of themselves.
Yep.
And they, and the government wasn't helping them.
Yeah.
And that was a big problem. So when you do something like this, which is basically going back to the '80s and not talking about the things that are affecting the people in your own country. Yeah. This is fucked up. So
yeah, this is, this CDC is like the fundamental place for public health and expertise in disease tracking, real-time emergency response, groundbreaking research. They literally are open 24/7.
Yeah.
Because health affects us all the time.
Yeah.
Like, I just, it's ridiculous. And this is, again, this goes back to just another, like, why is this your priority? What do you get from this?
I ask that every day.
You know what I mean? Like, but like, what's there, again, it's another representation of like, what's the strategy? You know what we need to do? We need to tell the CDC what not to say.
Yeah.
What?
Something, speaking of something you shouldn't say.
Yeah. So
yes,
I've never heard you guys, I don't think I've heard you both say fuck on the podcast
at the same time.
Yeah. It was very, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm usually the one that's like, ah, I mean, this is fun. I mean,
it's
not
because,
fun.
It's because
sad,
you're closest to the Christmas tree. There's a lot of joy.
I am sitting next to a Christmas tree.
So anyway, so we're going to go to Emily's favorite topic, Russia. So first, Putin thanks Trump for CIA's help in stopping terror attacks. This is a CNN article by Dakan Adon, Sebastian Shukla, and Pamela Boykoff. So President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin spoke by phone on Sunday, this is last Sunday, after ISIS-inspired terror attacks against the city of St. Petersburg were thwarted by Russia's Federal Security Service using intelligence provided by the CIA. Sunday's call was the second between Trump and Putin in 3 days.
I think this is actually today.
This is today?
Yeah, the phone call was today.
Oh, I meant like...
No, yeah.
Because this is Monday, technically, when we're...
Oh, you're right.
Yeah, you see what got... Yeah.
You're right. Technically, you'll be hearing this on Monday.
You'll be hearing... So Sunday's call was the second... and then they spoke on telephone this past Thursday when they discussed the U.S.-Russian ties and the increasing tensions surrounding North Korea.
I just think it's interesting that they've talked on the phone 2 times in the last 3 days. Again, I'm not trying to put my tinfoil hat on, but we're going to tell you some other things that are happening. I think we should just go into this.
Yeah, just go into it. So Manafort gets $10 million bail and can travel to Florida. Another CNN article by Caitlin Palance. So a federal judge released former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort from his house arrest on a $10 million bail. He will be allowed to live at his home in Florida and will be under curfew and GPS monitoring. He'll be able to travel to Washington for court appearances and to meet with his legal team, but he otherwise must stay in 2 counties in Florida. He can't go near any airports, train stations, or bus stations unless he gets approval for travel from the judge in advance. Manafort already surrendered his passports when he was arrested, and now his wife, Kathleen, must surrender hers according to that order.
Yeah, that's nuts. And then this is also nuts. So there's always this Russia stuff.
Yeah.
So the Trump transition team has been really upset for the past week because Robert Mueller, our favorite figure of justice, has obtained emails that were sent from the General Services Administration, was working with the Trump transition team, and they turned over like thousands of emails of communications. And Trump's law team, team of lawyers, I'm really not saying this well, have gotten really upset Trump's law team this fall.
The clown
Captain
car.
But yeah, so there's a Washington Post article. It says Trump's transition team charges Mueller obtained emails improperly, but legal experts challenge those claims. So Mueller's investigation is looking at whether any crimes were committed as part of what U.S. intelligence agencies say was systematic Russian meddling in the election Trump won. Trump has consistently said there was no collusion between his campaign and Moscow, an assertion he repeated Friday. The Trump transition alleges that the handover was done by career staff at the General Services Administration and suggested that those employees may have had political motives. Randall Eliason, a former federal prosecutor who teaches white-collar crime at George Washington University Law School, which is like one of the best law schools in the nation, said it was not at all surprising that Mueller's team sought Trump transition emails. He said it would be almost prosecutorial misconduct for them not to. He said that it was also not surprising that Mueller would ask the GSA for emails sent using government accounts. This is a big one because now we have thousands of emails between transition officials, which is the focus of this investigation.
But his emails.
Which is also, what beautiful poetic justice. Mm-hmm.
Thousands.
I wanted to talk
pages.
About this because over the past week, the Republican Party, the Republican media, Republicanism in general has been trying to make Robert Mueller seem like a biased individual because there were members of his team, his investigative committee, that have been removed because they had the text came out saying
that was
that
months ago too.
Yeah, and they removed them because there were texts that said less than glowing things about the president. And because of that, they said that Mueller now has this biased team that is trying to take down the president. Fox News ran a chyron the other day that said, "Is a coup coming in America?" Or something like that. Like a coup is happening to America.
Grab the pitchforks.
Which is ridiculous. The Republican Party is clearly getting very nervous about this as this investigation deepens, and they're trying to do anything that they can to discredit it. Just to remind you guys that Robert Mueller is the former head of the FBI, and he was the head for 12 years. FBI terms are normally 10 years, but he was given an extra two by the Obama administration because he was that good at his job. Mm-hmm. And they want to make it look like he's just running this Democratic-controlled group to take down the president. Mueller is a registered Republican, and the current head of the FBI, who was appointed by Trump, Christopher Wray, has made over $30,000 in donations to Republican campaign races. So has Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, also appointed by Donald Trump. He has made over $30,000. That came up because Christopher Wray and Rod Rosenstein were questioned by, I believe, the Senate Intelligence Committee this week. Mm-hmm. There is, you can have a campaign donations and then have impartiality in how you conduct your business and conduct your practice. In the event that Robert Mueller is fired, which a lot of people are afraid we are going towards that becomes sure. a constitutional crisis.
Yep.
And there is a group, if you go to act.moveon.org/event/Mueller firing rapid response, or you can search.
We'll tweet that out.
We can do that probably.
You can search "Nobody is above the law." Mueller firing rapid response. Sign up for this. This is a big thing that's happening. There are a coordinated group of rallies and protests set to simultaneously take place in the event that Robert Mueller is fired. If he is fired, I cannot stress enough that is a constitutional crisis. It's bad. That's real bad. And the Republican media suggesting that a coup is taking place and suggesting that the investigation has led nowhere. You don't turn in an essay halfway through, okay? The investigation, this might be the removal of the president. It might be the removal of the vice president. It might show that Neil Gorsuch is an appointed judge who has already done a lot of things that are not really in conjunction with the law. We're talking about a very, very big moment in American history. And if they want to go ahead and be on the side that said that this was not okay, and they want to try and fire him, we have an issue on our hands. Right. So
yep.
Get ready to get involved.
All right.
That was my rant.
Yes.
Yeah, that was a great rant.
There, I'll throw in my word.
Good job, Nick.
Well, so essentially next right now, Paul Ryan sees his wild Washington journey coming to an end. This is a political article by Tim Albert and Rachel Bade. So having spent a quarter century in Washington as an intern, waiter, junior think tanker, Hill staffer, and since 1999, a member of Congress, he's never wavered in his obsession with fixing what he viewed as the nation's two fundamental weaknesses, its Byzantine tax system and ballooning entitlement state. Now, with House Republicans celebrating the once-in-a-generation achievement of a tax overhaul, Ryan was feeling both jubilant and relieved and a little bit greedy.
Yeah, this is
painting an interesting picture of him.
I know. I'm glad that he's going.
I wanted to, potentially, because the other day he did say, he's like, "Oh, I'm not going anywhere." But essentially now it's starting, the cracks are in the mirror and it looks like he's wanting to exit. And, you know, I'm like, okay, good. You can leave.
Yeah.
I'm fine about it.
Yeah.
I just don't know what, I haven't seen like the spine of this man. is what I was what no. I would say. And like everyone's talking about his lofty career and everything in his service, but like I honestly think Paul Ryan, where he could have spoken up even against Trump, but against many other people, he seemed to have towed the line too many times. And he could have made a mark within Trump's first year of like calling him out when he could have. He could have done that. He could have spoken out against some of the things that Trump's, but no, he's laid low and he's just let the Republicans kind of be taken advantage of by a maniac.
Yeah.
And
he does not, he's not going to have a legacy of doing anything good.
Yeah.
So we wanted to move this into our candidate to get excited about before we go into our amazing interview with Michael Blake. Which we'll talk about in 1 second.
Yeah.
But our candidate to get excited about is Randy Brice.
Who we've talked about a few times, but we wanted to highlight. He's, this is like a triple threat. He's a U.S. Army veteran, a cancer survivor, and a union iron worker. Like, just, what? That's so great.
Pretty cool.
Anyways, you can learn more about him on his website at www.randybriceforcongress.com. He found his way into as an apprenticeship as an iron worker. He's now been helping to build America for more than 20 years. He's very active in the union as the political coordinator for Iron Workers Local 8. And recently is a member of the Milwaukee Area Labor Council Board of Directors. He is very passionate about healthcare, especially in response to what Paul Ryan has not been doing or doing to strip it away. He currently serves as the president of the Wisconsin Veterans Chamber of Commerce Board of the Directors and the chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin Veteran Caucus. His platform is fucking beautiful. Instead of fighting for a single payer tax care system, or he does fight for a single payer tax care system so that we can all be healthy and receive treatment. He fights for working people, lifting the economic floor and fighting for a $15 minimum wage, investment in our workforce, and support for organized labor and tax fairness. He believes in reversing climate change, investing in renewable energy, and protecting the environment. He defends women's healthcare and reproductive rights. He's committed to real refinance, real campaign finance reform that actually empowers people to run and to speak their mind. And then he has he believes in comprehensive immigration reform. So the next primary is August 14th, 2018. And the
day before my birthday.
Happy birthday, many months in advance. The election date is November 6th, 2018. So we have lots of time to support him. There was an interesting Washington Post article back in June. And the title was "This Union Iron Worker Wants Paul Ryan's Job. And he's got a great ad, but a losing record." And I think that's fucking exciting. So let's make sure he doesn't win. Because now a new article by Politico, or in Politico, by Edward Isaac Dover. On December 10th says that he just trails 10 points. He just trails 6 points to Paul Ryan. So even in just the past month, he's seen some momentum come up. And so I think it's really exciting that we have a quote unquote real person running against this joke of a person.
That's very exciting. So net neutrality got repealed. Hopefully we'll be able to fight to get it back or to keep it getting from getting fully repealed. The CDC has had problems. Obviously with censorship, there's the Russia investigation, which is coming to like a climax at this point. Get involved, call your Senate representatives, call your House representatives, call your local city council representatives. These phone calls matter. It matters. Everything matters. All hands on deck. Have good mental health. Have a great holiday. We have an amazing interview coming up with Michael Blake. He is currently a New York Assemblyman from the 79th District, and he's one of the co-chairs of the New Leaders Council, and he is a vice chair of the Democratic National Committee. We are super excited to have him on. Stick around.
We'll be right back.
Hey guys, welcome back to We Rebel. We're very excited. We have a New York Assembly member from the 79th District, Michael Blake, who's also one of the co-chairs of the New Leader Council and a vice chair of the Democratic National Committee. So thank you for coming on the podcast.
Great to be with you. Doing what we have to do right now in a car from Atlanta to Charlotte. That's my dedication right now.
Yeah, you're in the flight blackout that's happening right now. That's...
You know, I mean, I'm used to having difficult travel on the holidays since my birthday's on Christmas Day, but this is ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. Well, happy almost birthday.
There we go. Thank you now.
Yeah.
All right. So Michael, first and foremost, like we ask most of our guests, tell us how you became engaged in politics and tell us a little bit how you got your journey started.
know, in many ways, and thank you for having me, it started from the very beginning. My full name is Michael Alexander Blake. I'm named after Jamaican politicians. My mom came to the States and for 40 years worked at a manufacturing plant. My daddy, for close to 28 years, mopped hospital room floors, 1199 SEIU. And, you know, I went to PS79, which was the elementary school written about by Jonathan Coulzel, Savage Inequality Children in America Schools, 118 DeWitt Clinton High School, went to Northwestern. And in Northwestern, I had that second major turning point, if you will, the first of which was I was born with a heart murmur. And I was in 9 weeks. The second of which was I fell asleep at the wheel in 2001. And the only reason I didn't go over the cliff other than the hands of God was the amount of luggage I had in the car.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, I wrote out something to myself at the end of that year that said, Dear God, may today be my greatest day, greater than the great day I had a day before. But my goal has not been met unless tomorrow is the greatest of them all. And so, you know, I tell people regularly that when you have moments like that happen, you appreciate getting a second and third chance, quite frankly. And you appreciate really following your passion. And I always had an interest in initially using journalism as my way to get into politics. I wanted to be a sportscaster. I love sports. I love journalism. I love the impact of great announcers. You know, I think about when I was little and I would listen to just how Keith Jackson would talk in college football and old Nelly, right? They would just, it would it's going in the middle of the game. And, you know, I just thought about how that reflection point happened. And, you know, it was crystallized that in 04, I introduced Tom Brokaw as our commencement speaker at Northwestern. And so I was working in TV. And I took on an internship in 2005 and with a state senator. And my internship gave me more joy and more fulfillment than anything else I had done. Because we helped a woman keep her home. And she said, if you don't do this, I'm going to lose my home in a week. Mm. And I thought about my mom who was homeless. I thought about how we almost lost our house in the Bronx. I thought about the journeys I've seen so many people endure in the Bronx. And then that was the turning point. So I was offered a job to be a political director. Unite here, the president of the company told me that his son was a deputy political director for this guy named Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. And I joined the first ever Yes We Can training program in 2006 and was a part of that group of 10 that was trained in politics, and they sent me to Michigan to go run 3 state house races. We won all 3, and that was the beginning of a close to 7-year journey with then Senator Obama before he was president-elect, before he was president.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would say the arc of all that answer is to say that, you know, journeys are not supposed to be easy if it's worth it. And I really do believe that there is no more comprehensive way to help people than through public service. I really do believe that. And that is what brought me to today.
That's amazing. And I do want to bring up, too, that so you bring up your work and we want to talk about with President Obama's campaign, because he said that you were one of his most outstanding young organizers in Iowa back in 2007. And then he said, we wouldn't be here without Michael Blake. And one of my favorite, honest to God, favorite movies is By the People, the Election of Barack Obama. And that's how we interviewed Ronnie Cho. And I've seen you since I was like, I remember like being younger and looking into politics, and your story in that documentary is incredible. So even interviewing now is very cool, on a personal level. But,
and what were those early days like?
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm curious, what were those early days like with all of those new fresh faces and the young Barack Obama?
Well, you know, most people didn't believe we had a chance. Mm-hmm. And the candidacy and election of Senator and then President Obama, to me, is the epitome of faith. Right? I know that I was not the only one, but there were several staffers who were told by their, at that point, current and then soon to be previous employers, they were Hobbs because they anticipating that after Iowa we would be back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the reminder of that we were down by 30 points in the bowls nationally, and how I will never forget the night when Senator Obama came to Des Moines to speak to a lot of donors, and he said to them, you know, let me tell you a quick story. When I ran for U.S. Senate, I was at the St. Patrick's Day parade. I was the last entry of the parade, which means I was behind the police horses. But it also means that I was around people who had been drinking for a while. And I was going through this parade, and people were saying Barack Hussein Osama for hours. And he said a year later, because I kept putting in the work, I was the Grand Marshal of the same parade. And it was one of those moments where you realize that you're working for one of those once-in-a-generation people, right? And for us, it was hard because you're going in this space where race is real and the challenges of race are real and the dynamics of it cannot be ignored. And I was this young, skinny black guy from the Bronx trying to help get a young, skinny black guy to Chicago and Hawaii elected in Iowa, right?
Yeah.
And yep.
So, you know, those early days for 10 months, I started March 4007, it was an indication of what's possible. And what I say to people now is when you create a game plan, when you have a vision that people can believe in, anything is possible. Mm-hmm. Anything is truly possible. And it was not done after Iowa. You know, people forget that in New Hampshire, that day the polls were saying we're up, we were going to win, everything was going to be fine. Then we lost New Hampshire. Then Nevada was essentially a tie. We get to South Carolina. We finally took it back. Then you go to Super Tuesday, and then you're battling until June.
Mm-hmm.
It was not easy, but it was worth it. And I never in my wildest dreams ever thought I would work at a White House. Never in my wildest dreams thought I would work for a candidate president. Barack Obama shows you that if you truly have something in your heart to go after it.
Yeah. And I'm curious now, too. So you went from organizer to working in the White House, and you were the deputy political director for Obama's presidential election, then the associate director of public engagement and deputy associate director of the Office of Intergovernmental Affairs. So you were very busy.
I was like a good Jamaican. I had multiple jobs.
Yeah. How was it going from organizing to then working in the White House? What is the difference between campaigning and then governing that you noticed?
Well, the first very major difference is when you govern, you have to serve everybody.
Mm-hmm.
When you're campaigning, you're focused on how do you get an electorate that will vote for you, right? So it's a substantial difference between the two. It's a realization that, you know, you may have X percentage of people who believe in you, but when you're governing, you have to help 100% of the people, mm-hmm. right? And so it's a very different mindset. Campaigning is you do things with an understanding that can be very temporary. Governing, you understand you're doing things that can have generational impact. You know, and so it's a very unique difference and skill set. You know, you realize that a campaign goes much faster. That you are essentially operating to win one day, which versus in a governing organization. You can pass a bill today in which that bill may not even get fully implemented for years, you know? And so it's just the speed and scope and scale, quite frankly. You know, Tom Perez, who's our chairman of the DNC, you know, one thing he says often is that the thing he misses most about government is being able to help at scale, that you could have one regulation that could help millions of people at one time. And versus on a campaign, you are conveying to people why they should believe that you can help change their life, right? So there's a shift that's there and a shift in that belief process. You know, a campaign, you're getting someone to believe, and governing, you're showing them why they should believe even more.
And, you know, it's interesting that you're talking about making changes that can impact, you know, generations. And, you know, you've stayed active, you know, even after Obama's been out of office. You know, you're an assembly member in the Bronx in New York, the 79th district. And, you know, like, what's it like now? You're working on the national scale, and now you're like, but something in you said, I want to help my community. I want to go back to the smaller, to like, to down my block. Like, what brought you back to wanting to help out back in the Bronx?
What's the point of me doing all of this and not going back home to help people? You know, President-elect at that point, Obama, incoming Senior Advisor Valerie Jarrett, incoming Chief of Staff to Senior Advisor Valerie Jarrett, Mike Stratmanis, could have chosen any of millions of black people to run their black outreach. You know, and the level of gratitude with humility of being the first African-American outreach director for the first African-American president, I think about the fact that they gave me that opportunity, the fact that I was able to be there when healthcare got done, the fact to be there when it came to helping minority women-owned businesses, when it came to the policy and my brother's, all these different things. You know, I came home because I want to implement that vision at home. You know, my daddy was getting sick. He passed away in 2013. I helped run a campaign that year also. And an opportunity happened where my predecessor made a terrible decision and had to leave office. And at the end of the day, you know, this was an opportunity to go from helping realize a vision and talk about it to being about it. And, you know, to be able to be home in the Bronx, the most diverse county in America, poorest congressional district in the country, and to be able to say, you know what, if we can do it here, we can do it anywhere, that inspires me, and that's what keeps me going, and that's why we've been able to do the work that we've been able to do in the last 3+ years, which, you know, quite frankly, has been game-changing, and it's because a lot of people believe in us, and what keeps me going is someone believed in me, and I maybe there'll be one, that one kid who will see me, and they will think, okay, I can believe in myself.
And that goes, I think, to the New Leaders Council, which you are a co-chair of, you know, trying to train the next generation of progressive leaders. How did you get involved with this group? And if you could tell us more about it, because we want to highlight this amazing group. With we were looking at the other co-chairs of this that include Tim Kaine and Fiona Ma and yourself. I mean, it's an amazing group.
I don't believe there's an organization that has the impact that New Leaders Council does in the country right now. You look at the fact that we are an organization that was created after the re-election of President Bush, and people were saying, okay, what are we going to do now? How do we help change the narrative of what's going on? And to really then organize and mobilize millennials. A lot of people may not realize that in 2018, millennials will be the largest voting bloc in the country. And so when you look at an organization that has close to 6,000 millennials that have now been trained on communications, on campaign management, on policy, on messaging, on infrastructure and organizational planning, which even if you don't run for office yourself, even if you're not a campaign staffer yourself, that you can take those skills and help create change in your respective communities. That's why NLC is so remarkable, because we're helping shift the dialogue across the country. The Millennial in the Economy Compact that we've created now to demonstrate the impact that millennials will have across the board in the economic aspect. The conversations that we're now having in New York called Gotham Talks, effective in 2018, to say let's have conversations around civic engagement, the chapter engagement that we're doing in New Jersey, in Florida, in Detroit, in Atlanta, in Colorado, etc. It's showing what's possible when you put young people in office and in leadership itself. And so for me, you know, what I first saw was a group that a few of my friends told me about in New York City. And I went to learn about it. You know, a good friend of mine, Matt Kaplan, said you got to sit and talk with this remarkable woman named Heather Grantham, and said, you know what, I just want you to learn about what they're doing here. And I sat and I learned, and I was fascinated by it, and I went to a few of their events in New York City, spoke at a few of their events, and then they asked me to go speak at their national conference. And at that national conference, I just gave them my all, and I told them, I am you. And that we have a responsibility as millennial leaders to be giving back, and told them about my story. And now for 2018 and beyond, NLC, our focus is to train the next generation. Our focus is to get more people created into the pipeline, and to make sure that more people around the country understand that millennials are not just supposed to be, in their minds, optional. We are mandatory to be at the table.
Amazing. It sounds like you're in a really unique position where you're currently in local office, you're working on the national level with the DNC, and you're working in essentially professional development for new leaders. So you're one of the few people that are getting a true holistic view of what's happening now in progressive politics. So I'm curious how those three roles are supporting each other and any potential themes that are coming up in your day-to-day life.
Well, the theme that's continual for me is equity and the reality around that framing. So in my local office, we have a vision called 3-2-1, which is the three E's of economic development, education, and equity. The two paths of strengthening minority and women-owned business enterprises to create access to capital, access to contract, access to opportunity to create jobs, and while also having a career-oriented education system so that someone can go from the cradle to the career with one goal of transforming the South Bronx so that we become the urban metropolis of the world. And so that kind of thinking, where we're the second place in the country to have the American Entrepreneurship Award, Miami being first, a 10-year commitment from the Lieber Group to help entrepreneurs on the ground, to what we're able to do around my brother's keeper, and so that young men of color can have an opportunity, young boys and men of color can have an opportunity they didn't have before, to raise the age so that 16 and 17-year-olds are not tried as adults any longer. I'm able to then take that and say, okay, how do we help identify candidates around the country that lead with their values, that say, yes, I can disagree with Trump, but I'm going to tell you why you should vote for me, and I'm going to tell you why we're good at what our vision is and what we can do, and show them that you can organize in urban, rural, and suburban areas and win, and not be afraid to demonstrate your values, i.e. Doug Jones, who said, let's be clear, I'm not going to be against the woman having their choice and what they decide to do with their own bodies. And you may not like that, but this is who I am. And this is what I believe, right? And I really do believe that when you're real with people, they'll respect you for that. And then take that to what we're doing with NLC to be able to demonstrate to the young people, look, you can do this. I turned 35 on Christmas Day. And I want people to believe and understand that your age is not a limit on your possibility and your promise. And if you are willing to put in the work, if you're willing to live out the rule of the five P's of proper preparation prevents poor performance, if you're willing to go through the mindset that your block won't block your best blessing and your zip code won't deny your destiny, then you'll understand that all these worlds can come together, that you can be a strong local elected official that helps your people and takes that same level of values of helping people to the Democratic Party and saying that Dems will care and Dems will fight for you and Dems will stand up for justice, while at the same time finding young leaders who will be at the table. Look, put in perspective 2018, that I don't believe in coincidence. 2018, as I mentioned, the year millennials be the largest voting bloc, is the 50th anniversary of Dr. King and Bobby Kennedy being assassinated. An opportunity simultaneously that you could potentially take back the House and Congress. And now, because of what happened with Doug Jones, quite frankly, have a shot for Senate. You have a chance for a transformational opportunity. And so what our job has to be is saying at the end of the day, if you lead with your values, if you lead with the mindset that President Clinton said years ago, that shared values and shared responsibilities lead to shared benefits, that if you do those things, it doesn't matter what the task may be, you can be successful in helping the people.
Now, everything you just said, I think we wholeheartedly agree. Like, and that's the kind of passion and drive that all of us are expecting, coming into 2018, because there's a lot of very important elections coming up. That being said, if you would have talked about this a year ago with the DNC, a lot of people were at odds with what was going on in terms of the Bernie and Hillary campaigns. And a lot of people were upset with how the DNC handled that situation. So now, based off of what you just said, is the DNC, do they also have that mindset? Are they really listening and wanting to find these progressive candidates that you guys are training? Are they willing to listen to the people so that they know they have a candidate that they trust, that feels like they are listening to their problems?
Yes. Mm. Absolutely. Let's look at the track record from this year. Virginia, Ralph Northam, a man who is brilliant clearly in healthcare since he's a doctor, refused to back down in fighting and talking about Medicaid, despite how all the other noise around the country was saying otherwise. Where in Virginia, the number one issue people voted for was healthcare, where not only was Ralph Northam elected, but you had Justin Fairfax get elected as the second black person ever elected statewide in the Commonwealth. You had Mark Herring get reelected. You had 15 minimum pickups in the legislature, including two Latinas, including a transgender candidate, including just game-changing opportunities in Virginia. It happened because we found people that led with their values. It happened when you have a seat mayor gets elected in New Jersey. It happens when you have a black woman get elected mayor in Charlotte and a black woman get elected in Atlanta. It happens when you have a lesbian mayor gets elected in Seattle, first female mayor since 1920s. It happens when people don't shy away from their values. This is the new DNC, in which we're very clear about this, that you stand up for what you believe in, what you fight for, what is important to you, and we're going to have your back. You know, a lot of people were asking us, you know, what could be possible in these races, but the reality is, one of the few good things that happened because of 2016 is that people are awake now. People are not sitting on sidelines. People want to go do something. And so that's why we have support groups like New Leaders Council, like Higher Heights, like Indivisible, like Flippable, like Swing Left, all these different organizations, like The Collective, like Run for Something, like Emerge, all these different organizations that are trying to help people, because our job at the DNC is to create the infrastructure for success. Realizing a lot of different organizations will have very focused and tailored efforts. But then we take it to the next level of realizing, you know what, we will be an organization that will focus on electing a president every 4 years. We will be focused on getting people elected every 4 weeks. That's why we have a new mantra called Every Zip Code Counts. That's the reason why our new motto is very clear, from the school board to the Oval Office, of how do you go from the school board to the Senate, from the city council to county to Congress, from the state house to the White House. Everything matters. Everything's across the board. Why? Because everyone can keep talking about Trump and the disaster that he is. Look, Trump's a disaster. Pence is a joke. McConnell's an abomination. Ryan is another joke. Whatever you want to use for any wording, I'm going to tell you how I feel. They all terrible.
Yes.
That's all they are, right?
Yeah.
Because they lie and they don't care about the people. It is clear and obvious about this. So when we think about why elections matter, the attorneys general that have been elected matter because they can help push back against unconstitutional Muslim bans. The mayors you elect matter, so you can say that when it comes to infrastructure in your communities. The governors and legislators you elect matter, so that you can have a chance for better jobs and better educational opportunities. The district attorneys you elect matter, because when you have a racist, sexist administration that is going after you in every possible way, where Department of Justice is clearly attacking us in every possible way, you need district attorneys going to stand up on the ground in your communities. And so this is the new DNC. This is the new vision that we have. This is the vision that we have on the ground. And I think going back to your previous question, the reason why it gives credibility is I can say Khalif Browder was my constituent. So when I talk about raise the age, it's not theoretical. It's real. When you talk about police brutality, I experienced it in high school. I experienced it as a politician myself. You want to talk about schools? I can talk about what happened in my elementary school. You want to talk about healthcare? I can talk about how I had a heart murmur. My mom was a breast cancer survivor. We talk about it from a very real way. So when you have the new leadership of the DNC, someone like Tom Perez, the first Latino chair of the DNC, who was a former county elected himself. When you look at myself and Karen Carter Peterson, the state senator. When you look at how you have Keith Ellison and Grace Meng in Congress. You have representation, a diverse representation from across the country of different walks of life. Maria Elena DeRazzo, Latina, Unite Here, Vice President of California. Jamie Harrison, former chair from South Carolina. this is a new vision because we are connecting with people where they are on the ground. It's not going to be top down out of D.C. It's about meeting people in their zip code where it counts.
Yeah, I think that's amazing. And it sounds, it's almost like echoes of Howard Dean's 50 state strategy, but now it's even more down to the zip code, which I think is amazing. I want to ask about...
It's his strategy times 10.
Exactly.
Come on, show me love right now.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, exactly. It's like supercharged over that strategy. Now, I'm curious. I want to talk about Doug Jones because that's obviously in the news right now and everyone's so excited about that. And there's been a lot of talk about, you know, how the DNC was involved, but not overtly, because I think there were some lessons from the John Ossoff campaign. And I'm curious, moving forward in deep red states and areas like that, what is there a different game plan? Because I know sometimes in states like Alabama or deep red states, they don't necessarily like quote-unquote national Democrats showing up in that area. Is there a different approach to those kinds of races as opposed to a race in New York or California or something like that?
Well, there needs to be an approach to that Christmas tree in the background, whatever's going on back there. You need more lights. I know. That's the first thing. It needs a new additional approach right now. Now, we talk about Doug Jones, which I want to say in my Mike Jones voice. Doug Jones? Who? Doug Jones?
Yeah, there we go.
Right now, right? You know, Doug Jones, first of all, is a remarkable human being.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Let's not ignore, this is a white man from the South who, not his team, he prosecuted Klansmen who bombed the church. Right? Doug Jones was on his way to heaven before he even ran. Just something like that, right?
Yeah.
And for him to run in Alabama, a state that clearly is not an easy state to win in, a state which, again, for context, the last time a Democrat won was Richard Shelby, which a lot of, even this is important for education's sake. A lot of people don't realize that Richard Shelby, who is a United States Senator right now, was a Democrat. He changed 2 years later because of how difficult it was for him to be a Democrat there. For Doug Jones to win was nothing short of extraordinary, but it happened because, one, he's a remarkable candidate. Yes, Roy Moore was a terrible candidate, but Roy Moore was elected statewide before. So what I dismiss is how people are utterly dismissive of, well, Roy Moore is so bad. Well, the reality is Roy Moore only lost by close 2 points. And it's no different in a lot of ways than what happened with Donald Trump. Now, I think one major difference between the two is Roy Moore never admitted it, as Donald Trump did on the Access Hollywood tape.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all of a sudden, Donald Trump has amnesia. But for a lot of voters in Alabama, you know, that were with Roy Moore, they said, well, he didn't believe that. He didn't do it, right? So that made it a little bit more difficult in that aspect. But one thing, when you ask about the question around the DNC, we had to be sensitive and have to be sensitive, and this goes back to the previous point of, is it more important to help the people or to get credit? And at the end of the day, if you can put in an apparatus that leads to more than 325,000 doors knocked and more than 1.2 million phone calls, and to partner up with other organizations on the ground that are helping on the ground, it is far more important to do that than to have your name plastered all over the place and hurt him get a chance to be elected.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the end of the day, you know, when people ask me about the DNC, and they always are trying to figure out, okay, how exactly do you describe the DNC and the impact of those places? The analogy that's been hitting me the most recently is a general manager of a team, right? In which you may not fully understand the components that the GM does, but the GM's putting the pieces in place for success. You know, I'm a Yankees fan. I'm from the Bronx, so of course I'm a Yankees fan. But, like, The Giancarlo Stanton trade, you know, just, and walk with me for a second, because I think, again, this makes the set point of the Doug Jones point.
Mm-hmm.
That happened first because another deal didn't happen, right? The Yankees and LT were trying to get the sensation that was coming in from overseas. But because a culture had been created, because there was enough cap room, because they had enough resources, it created an environment for Giancarlo to say, as he said, you know what? I wanted to go to a place where there was an environment where I could go and get across the finish line, but they had the assets for success. Take it back to Alabama. We were able to say, okay, let's figure out ways to help you with technology. Let's figure out ways to help you with grassroots organizing on the ground. Let's hire consultants of color who can mobilize and have a target approach on the ground. Let's figure out different messaging that we can do. I did two events with Doug Jones myself, during Congressional Black Caucus Week, one with labor and one with millennials. And so our effort and the money that we put in for Alabama went purely to the ground game to organize and mobilize millennials who voted at a more than 60% clip for Doug Jones and for black folk, which, you know, as clear as can be, Doug Jones won because of black folk,
mm-hmm.
in particular, black women, mm-hmm. right? 98%. Now, that doesn't mean other people, I don't want anyone else to feel uncomfortable by that. It's just the reality of what it is, you know? And so I bring it back to the question in that this is the new DNC. The efforts that we were able to have in Atlanta to help Keisha Lance Bottoms get elected. The efforts we were able to have in St. Petersburg to get Rick Christman reelected. The efforts out in the state of Washington with Monka Dingra. There's a lot of things that you may not see, but it does not mean it's not happening.
Amazing. I feel like we could talk to you for 3 hours and still have more questions, but I feel that we have to wrap. So our final question is, you know, how beyond the traditional means of activism, like rallies and letters and calls, how can people get involved either on a hyper-local level or a national level in progressive politics?
Well, first, I just say thank you for anyone who wants to get involved, you know, because this is a moment that we're in right now where it's critical to get in the game. You know, you look at organizations like Generation Citizen, that because civics is not being taught in schools any longer, it's encouraging people to learn about civic and civic engagement. It's important. And so, you know, first, you know, of course, on the Democratic side, Democrats.org being our website, this Wednesday is a critical day, the 20th. Starting on the 19th, United We Dream is going to be having activations on the Mall for a Clean Dream Act. So Tuesday at 3:30 p.m. they'll be on the Mall, but then Wednesday at 11 a.m. December 20th, they'll be on the Mall to mobilize people to get engaged and get involved and say we want a Clean Dream Act. And quite frankly, again, you don't just have to be Latino to stand up for this. Latino, black, white, Native American, Asian, African, we should all be fighting for this all across the board. So wearehereTostay.org is the website for anyone that wants to support what's happening as it relates to the Dream Act and the Clean Dream Act. You know, if you want to get involved in what we're building right now, you know, follow us on Twitter @TheDemocrats. You want to follow me, I'm @MrMikeBlake. We have things happening in New York. We, of course, have things happening across the country. Follow us on IG, MikeBlake1922 on IG. Obviously, the Democrats, @TheDemocrats on IG. We want you to be a part of what we're building. And I'll leave you with this final anecdote before giving my final call to action. In 2000, Barack Obama ran for Congress. He didn't win. He didn't have the proper credentials to go to the convention that year to be there every single day. So after 2 days, he left out of frustration. Because he kept putting in the work, the same convention that he couldn't attend, 4 years later, he was the keynote speaker. And 4 years after that, after we took back Congress, 45 years to the day of Dr. King giving the I Have Dreams speech, Barack Obama was becoming the Democratic nominee. Things happen when you put in the work. And so we come to you with a level of excitement. We come to you with a vision of what is said in the word of God's politics, that we are the ones we waited for. We come to you with the vision of no one's possible. I come to you as someone whose family went from no house in Jamaica to the Black House at Northwestern to the White House in D.C. and now I'm in the State House at Albany. We come to you with an understanding of what we can be. And so my final call to action is to find a way to utilize your skills for good. If you're a lawyer, you know, get engaged in voter protection. If you are a PR expert, help us or help someone and become their press secretary and help them with branding. If you have a digital background, show someone how they can have brand elevation on the social platforms. If you come out from an effort of operations, show someone how to do a campaign plan and be a better in business management. Whatever your skills are, we can utilize you in the game of life. Why? Because in 2018, there are 24 seats we need to pick up the House majority. There are 20. polls right now that Hillary Clinton beat Donald Trump in. There's an opportunity next year. And in 2020, it's not just about a reelection and making sure that he is not reelected. It is about the census and the redrawing of lines so we can have fairer and more just lines across the country. So join us, hit us up, DM us, email me, blakem@dnc.org, blakem@nyassembly.gov. Help us, and we mobilize with you. And hope you have a wonderful and happy holiday. We're grateful for everything that you do, everybody.
Well, thank you. Wow. That's I'm pumped. I'm like fired up. Just
I want to go do something now.
Yeah. Well, guys, we just want to say thank you so much again to Michael Blake. He is an assembly member in New York for the 79th District, one of the co-chairs of the New Leaders Council, a vice chair of the brand new Democratic National Committee. Thank you so much for seizing the moment when it happened. I think we are all better for it. And thank you for coming on the podcast. This was amazing. Thank you.
Thank you. We rebel. That's what we do out here. Let's do this.
Yes.
Yep. Let's do it.
So for us, you know, like we said, this is our last episode of the year. So, you know, we really do wish everyone a happy holidays. Mm-hmm. Be safe, be happy, be healthy. And then we'll be back in the new year.
Check us out at We Rebel Podcast. We Rebel on Apple Podcast, whatsacreative.com. We Rebel on Twitter. We Rebel Podcast @gmail.com. We're also on Instagram.
Yeah.
So, check us out.
Yeah.
Thanks, everyone.
Happy holidays.
See you next year.
What's a Creative Podcast Network?